So this podcast is intended for UK and Ireland healthcare professionals only. It is my pleasure to welcome you to Series 2 and Episode 1 of the Interstitial Lung Disease Academy Spotlight Podcasts. It's brought to you by Boehringer Ingelheim and features prominent members of the UK and Ireland ILD community. The podcasts hope to shine a spotlight on the great work that is being done around the country and break down some of the challenges facing us in delivering excellent care to patients and working with patients. My name is Dr. Anne-Marie Russell, a clinical academic at the University of Exeter Respiratory Institute and Royal Devon and Exeter NHS Foundation Trust. I have a special interest in patient-reported measures and outcomes in interstitial lung disease and patient-centred approaches. Joining me on today's episode is Mr. John Conway, a gentleman who has a great deal of knowledge and understanding related to his lived experience of IPF. John is also a strong advocate for patients and set up a very dynamic and educational patient support group at St. George's NHS Trust for people living with interstitial lung diseases. John's patients' perspectives have also featured in the Spotlight series in The Lancet. Good morning. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. Great to be here.
So I wonder if I could start by asking a little bit about you as a person and the context of your life before you made that transition to becoming a patient diagnosed with IPF.
Indeed. And in fact, that's a really important question because it's so easy and so often that a person becomes their condition and their identity is lost. And it's something that I come across again and again within even my patient group from the support group's perspective. And they just lose all sense of nearly humanity. I've worked in academia. I've worked predominantly within third level education as a technologist. And I lived a fairly healthy life. Didn't smoke, social drinker, but I played lots of racket sports, badminton, table tennis, cycled and skied and did fairly kind of normal things. But, I was very much health conscious. So being diagnosed with what was considered a rare and a fairly kind of life, well, shortening condition at the very least, was quite a surprise. I remember back in when I was heading towards 50, I thought it might be worth going to my GP and just having a regular checkup. Once you're sort of heading towards the half century, it kind of does concentrate the mind a little bit, thinking, well, you might have been fairly lucky up to now. Let's make sure everything is okay. So went to a GP. I did mention at the time that I had this cough that I couldn't really get rid of, but I wasn't really particularly concerned about it. But my GP was just thought, well, just to be on the safe side, sent me for an x-ray. And that x-ray came back and it was clear. The following year, I went back and went had my regular MOT, as I call it. And I got to see the same doctor, which I thought was quite unusual these days to be able to do that. And she decided again just to send me to it for again an exploratory x-ray just to make sure everything was okay. Now those results came back and there was something in the kind of the basal regions of my lungs which kind of concerned her a bit, and she decided at that stage to refer me to a specialist. So that was towards the end of 2014 and heading into 2015. From 2015 onwards, I basically went through a series of tests to try and rule out and to try and find out what it actually could be. And with particularly with ILDs, as you're no doubt aware, there's a lot of sub-conditions it can be. And they, in the early stages, which this was, they sort of mask each other. So it's hard to really identify a true underlying cause. And sometimes you need time. But if some of the more, shall we say, severe conditions, then time isn't something you have an awful lot of. And with IPF in particular, which is one of the more stringent, if you like, conditions, that still has a prognosis, fairly poor prognosis of anything from 3 to 5 years from diagnosis. So you can sort of see that you may feel in a fairly good condition, particularly early in it, in the diagnosis, but you can rapidly decline. And that means you've got less function that you can actually do things with. So it's really important to get early diagnosis of a condition, particularly one that has limited treatment options as well, which this does. It only has 2 antifibrotic treatments that are currently on offer.
I think it's really interesting, John, that it sounds like you had a fantastic GP, and I think that's worth celebrating, because we can often be critical of our general practitioner colleagues. I'm interested that you were having a kind of regular health check and an MOT. I think that probably rarely happens these days, certainly under the age of 70. So it's fantastic that your GP picked up on the cough and decided to investigate. And I just wondered, if you hadn't had that GP input, do you think you would have probably just continued with those mild symptoms and not done anything about it, and possibly lost a couple of years?
I have no doubt that would have been the case. And in fact, it was really my wife that sort of kept nagging me, said, you definitely need to get that cough checked out. And I think that's often the case, that it's your spouse or those around you that identify that there is actually something that needs checking. And maybe I was being, it's fine, I'll work through it in some way. But it was very fortunate, and you're quite right. I have an awful lot of gratitude to my GP that she was so on it. She had actually taken a really good family history as well, so she could sort of see, because I did have, like, my father died from a fibrotic condition, back in the 90s. And it, again, so little was known back then. It wasn't that surprising that we didn't sort of kind of follow that through a bit more. Of course, in hindsight, we should have done a lot more. But as I say, at the time, the science wasn't that well evolved. But once that information was given, and that's why it's really important to really go back into family history, because you have no idea what in the past may indicate something that has come back to the present. And my GP, as I say, I'll be forever grateful that she had picked that up and had followed it through in a thorough fashion.
So after that, John, and just thinking back to that initial referral through to a specialist interstitial lung disease team, I think there's still a lot that we don't understand about familial IPF. I wondered if you could perhaps share some of your experiences with us about that familial diagnosis.
Well, yes, I mean, as it's turned out, the familial is probably the more accurate diagnosis for me, although obviously the working diagnosis was IPF. And even because I was in the early stages as well, it wasn't quite clear cut, because there's a number of kind of indicators that you need to have all of them in place. And that's why you need to have a multidisciplinary team make that final diagnosis. So anything beyond that, that does not have that multidisciplinary input really can't be considered a firm diagnosis, because there's so many aspects to it. And in the early stages in particular, that's why it's a really difficult condition to come down hard on in the early stages, which is such a dichotomy, because you don't have much time, if it is IPF, to be able to maintain quality of life. Because there's certain probably changes you need to make to your life. You need to probably do more exercise. You need to make sure that you're not over stressed, because stress can be a driver to it. That's something I've definitely have found out. So I reduced my stress, fairly early on. I mean, I worked at a fairly stressful job at a third level university. I enjoyed it, but with anything, there's always those stress situations. And they did their best to try and modify my work so that I could still, do it and be effective in it. And, I tried that for a while, but I realized I couldn't really provide the same quality as I wished and the job needed. So that's when I looked at being able to get more of a part-time role
elsewhere, which is what I did, and glad I did. And that was back in 2017. So that was 2 years following my confirmed diagnosis. And it was early in 17 that I basically went and managed to get my current role, which is at a community interest company involved in healthcare, ironically. So that's been, again, I've been very fortunate, and not everybody can do that to be able to reduce stress. If anything, you'll have maybe younger people than me who still have, full-time job. They've got a young family to support as well. So it's very difficult to see in those situations how, the stress can be reduced. But if it can, it should. And wherever it can be, then that's really important to try and do that, if at all possible. Continuing more around the familial aspect of it, because that means that there's a genetic component. And I've obviously gone on to various studies. I've been part of the 100,000 Genome Project, which I joined a number of years ago. And there's in excess of, it could be anything like 75 genes that have some way, have some impact around fibrotic conditions. And that's a lot of genes, and the way that they interact. I mean, I know very little, if anything, really, except in lay terms about genomics because of the tests I've been involved in. But it's a very exciting area for sure. And but it's you can imagine it's a really difficult area to become hard and fast about this gene or this expression has caused this particular symptom. And what can you do as well in regards to that? So, but it's definitely a developing area, and it's a bit like personalized medicine. You can sort of see it evolving in a similar way.
And so I guess that helps to have family support around you, people who really understand. And I guess also support from healthcare professionals is important too. And so I'm wondering that, you're living with a progressive condition. I guess you can't anticipate how it's going to feel until you're in that place of experiencing those symptoms and living with worsening symptoms. How did you manage those processes? And I know that you were successful in being referred for transplant assessment, John. But I just wondered if you could reflect and think about that period in life and what worked and what people can take inspiration from.
Well, it's really interesting, this whole area, because I remember, again, in the early stages, I remember I read this paper, and it was it basically concluded that an engaged and informed patient, irrespective of the underlying condition, had better outcomes. And I took great support from that and great encouragement that I just need to educate myself about this and find out what's good and what's not good and what I should be doing more of, and looking at diet as well as exercise and reducing stress. So I looked at a whole kind of conglomeration of strategies to try and, keep the worst parts of this condition as far into the future as I could possibly do. That's really key to know that there's a lot of research going on as we speak, and there's lots of patients signing up to those trials. And I would encourage people to do that, because it's only from patients signing to those trials that there's going to be any breakthroughs. Without patients, it just doesn't happen. I also remember once reading this paper about this patient who was having so much trouble just getting dressed in the morning. And I remember getting dressed one morning, and I was, fine, dressed in the normal way. And I was sort of thinking of that patient, thinking, that can't be me. I can't imagine that that's ever going to be me, because I was so fit and healthy. And it was probably less than a year and a half later, and I remember getting dressed, and that article came to mind, and it was, I was struggling getting dressed. So it was just showing how progressive and how rapidly I was progressing. And this is particular, I think, a feature, at least in my experience with familial PF. I do think it's a more severe form of IPF, and it generally can progress more rapidly. The steps it can progress in, of course, is you can have these exacerbations, which is this increase in symptoms you can have. And I did have a couple of those. I remember once being on holidays in Italy, Remember those holidays abroad? I remember one night waking up and I just had this fit of coughing and I just couldn't stop this coughing. And it went on for hours. It felt like hours. It probably wasn't, but it really did feel like it. And the pain that I got from it. And I just knew from when I got back and at home, and I remember going in for my next lung function test and it had dropped more than 10%. And I knew that was the event that dropped it. That can happen at any time. There was no one thing that I could say, oh, that probably triggered that exacerbation. It just come on, and it's such a random thing. And that's what brings me back to this point about if you can reduce stress, if you can become a bit more thoughtful in your actions. If you're someone who rushed, and I was someone who was always rushing, you know, I was rushing to the next meeting. And in the early stages, you don't feel it's progressing. You feel you're in a, what I would perceive as a, and people would perceive as a plateau. But it's not really a plateau. There is always progression. The medication does reduce the rate of progression. That's their purpose. They're not cures, but it is progressing. And it's only when you get to the end or towards the end stage of the condition that you really feel what that is. But in the early stages, you don't, because you could still more or less do the normal things. And that's why it's so important that when you can have that hiatus of still increased function, that you make the most of it, that you do the exercises, that you, you know, if you can go and visit people. I know in COVID that's a really difficult thing and you have to be careful all the time and make your risk assessments when you do go out into society, but you still should do that. You shouldn't become a prisoner either. So it's a balance and you always have to make that judgment. It's a judgment call. But to know the risks at the same time is really important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It certainly has been a particularly challenging time for everyone through COVID, but especially for people with interstitial lung disease as well. And John, I know you're a very hopeful person. And as you say, you educated yourself, you engaged with clinicians, you reduced your stress, you looked at maximizing your quality of life through a number of strategies. But you got to that point where you realized that the IPF was progressing. And I guess possibly had to start to think and contemplate your own mortality, which is difficult for all of us. I just wondered how you got through that, and being a younger man and eligible for transplant, how those discussions were facilitated.
Yeah, I mean, it's very true. I've always been quite positive, and I've always, you know, it's a bit of, you know, life gives you a lemon, you make lemonade. And I've always had that kind of philosophy on things. And no matter how dark things seem, you can always do something. There's always something that can be done. But then I got to a point, and this was towards the end of 2020. And I was, there was no light at the end of the tunnel. You know, I was really getting to a point of, you know, there's, what I was doing was I was looking back 6 months, thinking what I was able to do and what I was able to do now. And then it was quite easy to look forward 6 months and think, okay, that doesn't look a very good 6 months ahead of me. And I was having real difficulty trying to see where the positivity was. And I also, you know, my wife's kind of going through this journey as well. It's so easy to focus on the patient here, but it's really important to focus on the spouse, what they're going through. And in some ways, I think it's nearly worse for them because they're constantly seeing, you know, the person they love kind of wilt in front of them, and they're powerless to do anything, you know, whereas at least I was looking out from my position, and I could see the blue skies and the, you know, but I was also seeing my spouse, you know, suffering and not being able to help in any way, trying to, but, you know, it was just adding a kind of anxiety on top of anxiety. And I did get to a stage where I contacted, I have to say at this stage as well, and probably because I was very much at the end stage of the condition, there was very little that could be done. And it was becoming apparent that that's what my healthcare team thought as well, because I was becoming less engaged with them. At least this is on the secondary care side of things. So that kind of depressed me. It really did. I could understand it intellectually, but emotionally, it was really difficult because I felt they were giving up on me. I felt, you know, once you get to a point of where you feel there's no hope, that's the darkest place. It really is. And it's how do you get yourself out of there when you feel those around you that are there to help you and, you know, you trust them are more or less saying, well, John, there's not really much we can do. I think there was stuff that could have been done. I think, looking at hospice, you know, I think there isn't enough discussion about hospice because people are afraid of mentioning it, which is completely wrong in my view. Hospice care can be mistaken for it only provides end-of-life care, which, of course, is completely wrong. And even though I didn't myself kind of sign myself up to it, I do know a number of people who have and had and got a lot from it. And it wasn't to do with end of life. It was actually to do with engaging with life, engaging with society, and also managing conditions. And I don't think there is enough about that, managing symptoms. And once you view it in that way, and I think there's a lot of re-education needs to be done around that, particularly when you're at a stage, as I was at the end of 2020, where my options were, you know, evaporating before my eyes. But I did, I contacted my GP and I had explained to them how, you know, I was really feeling anxious, stroke, you know, depressed. I think I was probably on the cusp. And that's was such an alien term for me because I was just, my positivity was kind of my DNA, if that's not too much of a irony. And the GP obviously was extremely empathetic, understood, and had sent through medication, which was antidepressant, stroke, anxiety medication. And what happened is I didn't actually receive them until I was discharged from hospital following my transplant because I rang on a Friday. I got the call for my transplant operation on the Monday, and my medication arrived on the Tuesday. So it was there waiting for me when I came out of hospital just over 3 weeks later, having had a double lung transplant.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you more about that. I mean, it's so delighted that you were in a position to receive a transplant and that to it's been successful. I know it's not an easy process, but just to think about the time before that, and thankfully you had a very supportive general practitioner. I'm just wondering whether you think from the specialist unit, whether you were ever offered or whether it might have been helpful to have had a referral to psychology.
Yeah, I think it would have. I think it would have. Maybe I fell into a kind of a halo effect where because I was so engaged and, you know, I was trying to educate myself, maybe I fell off the radar a bit. Maybe there was an assumption made, if there's anything John needs, he'll contact us. We don't need to contact him. And I think that's a dangerous place to be. And again, it's in hindsight, I look back and I think maybe that's where, you know, I kind of fell into that, you know, between two stools in a way. And I can understand, you got to realize this was during COVID. So NHS, everybody in the NHS was working so hard, still are, but particularly then because we were also heading towards peak COVID in London, which is where I was based. It wasn't a usual period. So I think we need to be mindful of that too. There was lots of challenges happening. However, you know, I did feel at that stage somewhat abandoned, and I'm sure I wasn't the only patient at that time that felt that. You know, there was a lot of operations that were cancelled and even just appointments, and that we'll probably be suffering from that for some time to come. It's going to take some time for that to work out of the system, I would say. But going back to where my situation was, I was lucky. I had got to the end stage of my condition. I was losing all possible hope. And it's something that I'm very mindful of, that a family had to go through hardship and pain and suffering for me to gain a new life. They lost a loved one. And it's something I'm mindful of. And every day, I not just think of my donor, but their family as well. And what a sacrifice, and also what insight and what compassion they showed at a time when I had no hope. Let's face it. Even my consultant afterwards said that, yeah, he thought at that time, because it was in early 2021, thought I wouldn't make Easter. And he was right. There's no way I would have done that. So this was my only chance. And again, I felt so fortunate because this was the one and only call I got. And that is in itself unusual. Most patients, the first call is a dry run, as they call it, and maybe even the second one. And I wouldn't have been around for a second one. So the fact I had the first call and the first and only call, and I had received my transplant at that stage is just unbelievable. It really is. And I feel it difficult to even articulate what that is like. It is impossible to try and articulate it, but I'm forever grateful for everyone who was involved in ensuring that was operation was going to take place.
I think as well that you did quite a lot of the work. I understand at that time you were a very determined patient in recovery, and you were in hospital. We were mid-pandemic, and your wife was doing the best to support you, but I think visiting was probably restricted at that time. Mm. So I just for people who are listening to this podcast, I wonder whether you could share some of those experiences of waking up post-transplant, and that very short time actually of post-transplant experience in hospital.
Yes, it was. Well, again, I just before that, before the operation, even I actually drove myself to the operation because I was convinced that I would receive a telephone call cancelling the whole thing, that either the organ wasn't viable or something, because generally something does happen. So I thought, well, this is a dry run and we will get a telephone call and then we can just drive back home. However, that didn't happen. And I had so convinced myself that at some point within this next few hours that this would be the case. Even when I was wheeled up towards the operating theater, I thought, wow, they're leaving this very late in the day before they cancel. So convinced I was. And even when I was in the operating theater and there's a nurse that comes, the ILD nurse comes down with you all the way to sort of like hand over. And it was afterwards when I woke up and it was the same nurse that was there just to make things very familiar. And when I explained this to her, she said, well, that explains why you were so calm in the operating theater, because she said she'd never seen a patient that seemed to be just so laid back. It was like, you know, you realize you're going through a double lung operation, but I was convinced it wasn't going to happen. And maybe that was a good kind of thing, because it meant then that I was completely chilled. So when I woke up and realized it went ahead, I was probably as surprised as everybody else that it did. And then I thought, when they then told me it took me 4 days to wake up, I took that quite badly. I thought, I'm in a worse position than I thought I would be in. I thought 4 days practically in a coma. I mean, it was semi-induced because they quite rightly thought I needed the rest, because I come in fairly, I was quite emaciated by the time I got in, because I couldn't eat. I had no appetite. So to try and keep muscle and weight on was becoming near impossible for me. So I was in a fairly low way, even though everyone around me was saying, oh, that, you know, I've gone really well and I was doing well. But and this is where delirium kicks in, because I was they had given me so much immune suppressant medication prior to the operation, because they obviously want to make sure that the organ's accepted and there is no rejection or any risk of it, that they give quite a lot of medication. So once I came to 4 days later, I started seeing things. I remember seeing this tiny little spider at the end of the bed, and I said to the nurse, I said, "Oh, you got a spider in the bed." So I remember James came in, introduced himself, and I said, "Right, James," I said, "Are you on for Mission Impossible?" And he didn't know what I was talking about. I said, "I'm Mission Impossible. I want you to have me out of here in 2 days." Now that was quite an impossible mission, but he was a bit surprised and very much up for the challenge, because he says he's never had a patient say that to him. Generally, they want to stay in bed and just they definitely don't want to see a physio. And I said, "No, I'm whatever you want me to do, I'll do it." I said, "Can you get a bike in here maybe as well? I can do some cycling." So basically the next day, they had me up, with a lot of support. I could barely put one foot in front of the other. But by probably day four, I was sitting out on my own. By the next day, I was beginning to cycle. So I really did sort of set myself each day. I would set myself a longer target. You know, I'd walk 50 meters and then I'd try and double it. And they'd always be there to support me. But it's difficult to walk when you've got about four tubes attached to you and you have to carry those as well. But it was bit by bit, but it was important to set targets. It was important to have realistic targets as well. I didn't want to have any knockback. But it had to be a development. Each day I had to have some success built into it. And I think that really helped. And as soon as I was independent, I tried to get as independent as possible. So, you know, my first trip to the bathroom on my own was a milestone. So I made sure I got to that quite quickly. And then I was self-medicating within a few more days. So, and of course, that's really important. They want to make sure that you can medicate yourself, get the right drug dose and all of that at the right time. So I really did engage with that as quickly as I could. And there was at one stage, I was actually training some of the junior nurses that were coming to have a look around to how to connect various nebulizers and things like that that I was using. So that really did help me tremendously. As I say, I was out within just over 3 weeks of the operation. I was discharged, and I think that's really important. The attitude you must if you don't really get to a good level of understanding of your medication, a good level of what exercise you need to do and how regularly you need to do it and the rate at which you need to do it at. Those are really important, because you're going to do much better once you're in a more familiar environment at home than you will in hospital. There were still risks. As I said, I was, you know, I got my lungs when it was peak COVID. So you don't really want to hang around any place that COVID could be a risk.
So I think your determination is admirable, John, and I know you are who you are, but I think your story is very inspiring for others. I'm curious to know, having made it home, I guess then is another the start of another journey. Is that having lived with IPF for a significant chunk of time, is then you're transitioning to not being a patient who has IPF? Yes. And I wondered how that journey has been.
Yeah, well, I remember coming through the door, and one thing I hadn't mentioned, but because I was in such a bad wear prior to it, I had to get a stair lift installed. So when I came back home, the first thing I saw was on the stair lift, my wife had actually put down "out of order" on the stair lift. that was quite amusing. But the first thing I remember is ringing up my oxygen supplier and asking them to come and remove all of the oxygen canisters that I had stored and that I was using. and my oxygen concentrator, which was plumbed in through the house as well. So that was quite a moment when the supplier, Pete, actually turned up, and I have a video of them removing all of the oxygen. And that really did kind of put an underlying that I was in a new place. The fact that the only people, you know, that can say, you know, that, you know, I no longer, to be able to say I no longer have IPF, was something I thought I would never be able to say. I thought this is something that's a lifelong thing. So that was quite something. I did have to re-educate myself on how to breathe again, because when you get IPF, particularly if you're with it for, you know, pretty much towards the end, your breathing becomes very shallow, and that becomes a muscle memory for you. You become very used to breathing just very shallow. And that's a very bad way of breathing, particularly if you're trying to make sure that you're not going to get infection, because then you're going to obviously build up a petri dish for infection to be attracted to if you're not doing deep breathing, clearing mucus from the lower parts of the lungs. So that was something I, again, educated myself about, you know, doing the deep breathing, going through the breathing cycle as well, the huff cycle, to make sure that, because I still do that, I still clear out any mucus to make sure that I don't get any infection, because I'm still vulnerable. I'm still considered clinically vulnerable, and will do, because I'm on immune suppressants as well. So I try and keep those lungs, I treat them very carefully. You know, they're pretty much pristine, and I want to keep them as pristine as I possibly can. So I have great respect for them. And so that's part of my routine. It was part of my routine when I was an IPF patient, but it used to take me an awful lot longer, and it was for different reasons. This is very much just to keep things very healthy. So that's part of the routine. Doing regular exercise is something as well. I do have an exercise bike, and I had an exercise bike when I had IPF, but towards the end, I couldn't use it because it was just too hard to be able to use it. And now to be able to get on it and do 10K and up to 20K on it is quite refreshing. And again, underlines I'm in a different place. So I've done that. I've gone back to playing badminton again, which was a game I thought I would never play again. And it's something I really have, you know, I've played for a large part of my life. And only recently I entered into a satellite tournament for the transplant games, which was last month, and I played badminton competitively for the first time in about 4 years. And it wasn't easy, I'll give you that, but the lungs were fine. It was the rest of me that was the problem. I just wasn't fit enough. I wasn't back. I thought I was back to my normal self. You know what it's like if you're a competitive person, which I definitely am. You forget about maybe you need a little bit more training, and I definitely do. But I've now joined my club again, so that's something I hope to continue. And again, I'm very careful with COVID as well, that I don't put myself in any risk. And those who I play with are very much aware of my situation as well, so they're very very thoughtful, if you like, on ensuring they keep their distance. But yeah, so it, in a way, I am making the most of it. And I continue chairing my IPF support group. I did ask them if they wanted a chair that no longer had IPF, but they were resounding in their support that I continue, which was good. So, and I'm also now involved in many other groups, and I volunteer quite a lot around research as well, into genomics, familial, and IPF as well. I get involved in quite a lot of groups, and I intend to continue doing that. Of course, now I'm a great advocate and promoter of organ donation, and it's something I've already donated my organs to science, so there could be students slicing up my lungs as we speak. So hopefully there'll be some insights that will come from that will hopefully move forward the science around fibrotic lung conditions, and hopefully we get a cure, because that's our ultimate aim, really, in all the research that's going on at the moment, is to no longer have this as, I mean, you look at what's happened with cystic fibrosis patients, and that's great to see. We all rejoice in that, and we hope that one day IPF can have a similar celebration.
I think that is a perfect point to end, John, on that thought. I have to say it's been an absolute privilege and delightful to talk to you. And I'm so grateful for the generosity of your spirit and the sincere gratitude that you have towards your donor. I'm sure that would mean a lot to the family. And you are truly an inspiration to the, I know you don't like compliments, but you are an inspiration to the interstitial lung disease community and very highly regarded. And I think for me, perhaps I will reflect on those people that I work with who are expert patients, but it is important to remember that the role as a patient needs equal treatment too. I think that is something for us all to think about moving forward. So John, thank you so much for sharing your experiences, and I wish you all the very best.
Thank you very much, Anne-Marie, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about my journey. And I do hope that in some ways that it can bring some hope and inspiration to others going through it. It is a tough road, but there's still a lot that individuals can do to improve their own quality of life, and it's important that they keep that in mind. Thank
you. Absolutely. Thank you.